All right, Tim, this is going to be a heady discussion, man. We are here to debrief and deep dive on a recent Joe Rogan Experience podcast episode. It was number 1439. It had aired back on March 10th, so just about a week ago. And the guest is Michael Osterholm. And Michael Osterholm is an internationally recognized expert in infectious disease. Basically, the guy is a biosecurity expert. He called himself a medical detective within the episode. So we're going to talk about this episode, where we sit in the world with everything going on with the coronavirus. But prior to doing that, though, I just got to say, happy St. Patty's Day to you, man.
Likewise. So cheers, Ergo Broughton.
Absolutely, man. So, Tim, the first thing I want to ask you, Michael Osterholm, did this guy have any kind of agenda at all? What was your thoughts on him just as a credentialed dude? And then we'll start peeling the onion from there.
I thought the guy was as a straight shooter as you're going to hear on the subject. So I thought it was timely. It was salient. So, I mean, it was really fascinating that Joe was able to get this guy as a guest. So kudos to Joe Rogan for kind of anticipating this situation a week or weeks in advance. So he hit the nail on the head with asking this guy to come on a show.
Yeah, so this was March 10th when the episode aired. And Tim, real quick, think where we've gone in this country just in those 7 days. So when you and I are recording this, it's St. Patty's Day, March 17th. I think the cases around that time, the count was still around the 1,500, 1,000. I just watched the news for a few minutes. We're getting close to 6,000. So he talked about this exponential growth pattern that's going to unfold. And here it is happening right before our eyes. And I think the most concerning things that he had to say is, this is just the beginning. This is not a virus blizzard, he said, where we're going to have 2 to 3 days of staying home and then everything gets back to normal. He's saying this is going to unfold for months to come. I don't think he had an agenda at all. I thought he was very sober and steadied in his communication. He was not an alarmist, but he was also keeping it as real as could be. So this is, I think he said, it's going to be about 10 to 15 times worse than the seasonal flu. And it was concerning. How do you think the reaction within our country has been in context to the guidance and the sort of the measured alarm bells he was ringing? How do you think our response has been? Where do you think we're at today as far as a country in dealing with this?
Well, it seems to be changing every day, Mike. So this took place right Tuesday, March 10th. And I remember Wednesday, you know, more information was coming out. You heard about more, you know, states, municipalities, counties, especially in Pennsylvania, closing things. You'd have like school, you know, maybe one or two schools would shut down and a scare. But then on Thursday, March 12th is when it really started ratcheting up. They started canceling pretty much all sporting events.
Dude, by the way, real quick, I feel like the NBA really was kind of they jump-started this entire thing. For whatever reason, that suspension seemed to shake everyone's core and be like, oh, wait a second. This is what we need to be doing. Do you agree? Like, for whatever reason, the NBA seemed to be out in front of all of this.
Yeah, that's a great point. I guess it was because of the guy from the Utah Jazz.
Yeah.
The name escapes me. And then another player got it, and you know, credit to the NBA, they shut it down, and it seems like the right thing to do. Now, as of recording this episode, I don't know if you saw today, some people on the Brooklyn Nets were tested positive for coronavirus.
Wow. Okay, and I know there's been a guy from the Pistons, I believe, as well. So listen, they clearly did the right thing with immediacy in doing that. I feel like for us out in the public, it just set in at a deeper level, like, wow, this is where we're at, and things are going to start to change rapidly, and they absolutely have since then. How about response from government? You know, you and I always talk about how people hyper-focus on the federal presidential level. and how really change is enacted more at a local level. And I still hold that philosophy and agree with that. But I do feel in major earth-shattering times like this, we do need the steady hand and guidance of a president. I'm not a Trump guy. I have no problem saying that I'm left-leaning. I do feel something shifted with him, though, if you've been paying attention to Trump in the last 2 days. He's not the same guy addressing this that he was a week ago. There's a much more somber tone to it. He's saying things like, this is bad. This is going to be bad. Yesterday, he floated a timeline out to July or August until things could get back to normal. Your thoughts on the leadership of our president?
Yeah, you know, I don't think he, especially like you said, maybe 2 weeks ago. I think, you know, he came under, especially from a lot of people I talked to, a lot of criticism. And there's certainly things that he should be criticized for. I think the intent, though, was not to cause a panic, right? I mean, it's the leadership. It's, you know, it's top levels of our government. And the last thing you want to do, you know, not only just from a basic health standpoint, you don't want to cause a panic, rioting in the street type panic, but also economically, you don't want to cause a panic. And I think when the stock market, as a leading indicator, you know, just started just falling and falling, and the supply lines and that sort of things, you know, were shutting down in China, that's when it was like, all right, this is serious. You know, the leading indicators are telling us that this is not going away anytime soon, and we got to, you know, move mountains here to curtail what's happening. So I think once the stock market kind of like really the bottom fell out, I think that was kind of a you know, cold water being dumped on senior levels of government to take action.
But it also seemed, though, Tim, to tank in direct reaction to him speaking. It seemed like when he would come out within the day, the market would dive. And I heard someone say this. I thought it was interesting because Wall Street and investors knew that this was not a financial situation. It was a health pandemic situation, and they didn't hear anything about what the plan was to rally on that front from a containment, reduction, harm management response, and that potentially is part of what they were looking at. And listen, Trump, the position calls for someone to be a little more nuanced and to be able to thread the needle of not creating panic, but also keeping it real a little bit, setting some expectations. I think the worst thing that you can do is minimize something that calls for a bit of a dose of reality, because when that reality starts to play out and you've minimized it 2 days ago, that's the worst absolute look that you can create. But I don't even want to get hung up on him. I think the past 2 days, he and the whole task force have been getting their act together, hopefully, God willingly. Let's do this, though, Tim. Let's talk, and you brought this up about how Rogan lands this guy as a guest. Let's talk about Rogan's platform versus cable news outlets, the coverage we're seeing there, and what Joe's long-formed sort of open-air dialogue back and forth, allowing for their depth and breadth. Let's talk about the importance of Rogan's platform and landing a guest like this, and just talk about podcasts in general and the role they can play with what the world is dealing with right now.
Right. And, you know, because the 7 second or, you know, 2.5 minute bites videos that you're going to see on cable news are going to be, you know, people fighting in the supermarket over a roll of toilet paper and that kind of nonsense, as opposed to Rogan just asking, hey, what should we do? What can we do? What should we expect? And those kind of questions that, you know, that I found interesting. I mean, you know, Joe was like, they're just telling us to wash our hands and stay away from people, you know, maintain distance. And he's like, well, it's like the flu, it's airborne. It'll mitigate it, but it's not 100%. You know, this thing's gonna spread, and we just got to deal with it. I mean, he was giving real answers, you know.
Yeah, I thought that piece was interesting where he actually – kind of downplayed even the hand-washing piece like you just mentioned. Joe asked about it. Joe, first off, is like, let's talk about the mask. Are they nonsense? The guy's like, yeah, they're basically nonsense. He called out one specific type of mask, which basically no one out there is utilizing in the general public. But short of that specific kind of mask, the other ones don't really do much. And like you called out, he says it is an airborne transmission. So breathing is the biggest, quickest, most widespread way that this is going to get spread around. And I think you're right. Joe asked questions of this guy. Him having no agenda whatsoever, just asking everything we would all want to know and ask. But I feel like the media, and I'm not an attack the media guy. I know there's plenty of reasons to attack the media, and that's a whole other separate podcast. But I do feel there's at times where the media has sort of like a loaded question asking of these experts, or there's an angle they're going from. I felt none of that for Joe. He was generally curious and also wanting the general public just to get a better understanding of this. And I thought he traversed through the interview beautifully, getting the info. Look, it meandered a little bit. It kind of got into like hunting and sort of the things, but it was also interesting to hear about where some of these diseases come from, how it jumps from animal population into the human population through these meat markets over in China. Do you have any understanding of that at all? All the types of different wild animals are eating over there.
So there was a rumor, and I heard the same report in the news, that the potentially that this could have been a biological weaponized agent, because I guess there's a biological weapons facility in Wuhan, China, apparently. And Michael Osterholm kind of immediately put that notion to rest. He said, I have tremendous experience with working with bioweapons. I've worked with the U.S. government. I've had all this experience, and I can tell you almost, you know, definitively that this is not a biological weapon. This is not how they behave. Humans can't create something like this. Nature just does it better. And he says, you know, all the information we have suggests that this came from some sort of animal. And you know, So I heard someone else say, you know, this is a we have to learn the valuable lessons from this thing. You know, we got to learn that these open air meat markets in China, we have to do something about them because this is impacting the globe. The other thing that a lesson learned that Osterholm touched on is the whole, you know, supply chains of globalization. He gave the example of that in Puerto Rico. Prior to the hurricane that devastated their country, that 80-some-odd% of saline bags, IV bags, were made there. And when the Hurricane Maria hit, there was a worldwide crisis for, you know, IV bags for hospitals worldwide. So there has to be some sort of planning and contingency models out there, because he also said that, you know, almost 100% of these vital drugs come from places like China and throughout the world, and we don't make them. So if they shut down, like something like this happens, you know, we could potentially be cutting our legs out from under us. So it's important to learn these lessons.
Yeah, absolutely, man. So what do you think about some of the population out there? And I think it's a significant amount of population that is being outright dismissive of the severity, to the point of even mocking this virus. I understand if people want to take a stance that, hey, this is getting a bit overblown and dramatized. The flu is legitimately each year causing tens of thousands of deaths. We never get to a level of hysteria over that. Maybe we should start. But what's your take on maybe psychologically or ideology? Like, what is your take on the people that are just flat out dismissive and to a point of mocking what's been happening so far? And do you think that's starting to shift, where that's starting to go away? I still feel some of that out there. What are you hearing from that regard, and what are your thoughts on what could be at the core of that?
So part of my my day job there, Mike, it's not all podcasting, believe it or not, everybody, is to drive around, which I probably shouldn't be doing, and talking to people from, you know, all over the place. And man, I swear, over this weekend, I've talked to a lot of people that just were like this, you know, that had that kind of nonchalant, laissez-faire attitude about the thing. And I'm like, I don't know, man. But then I also talk to people that are like, I'm not leaving my house for 2 months. So, you know, I don't know if you should fall somewhere, you know, and sort of like the health professionals that I know, doctors and nurses that I talk to are just like, you know, mitigate being in crowds, you know, maintain good hygiene, and you should be okay. So I guess that's why it's important for kind of the sobering voices out there to tell you what to do, because you're really kind of hearing it from everywhere almost.
Yeah, there's just a lot of distrust out there. And I think a bad analogy, but maybe it's one that could explain it, is just even with the media and snowstorms and just blowing them out of proportion. Hey, massive storm coming on Wednesday. Everyone runs out to get the milk and bread, and then it ends up raining. I don't know if people have had that scenario ran through their head too many times, where now for anything that the media is going to talk about and cover, it's, oh, well. But to me, this never felt like the one to take that attitude with. And kind of early on, I just kept my eye on it. And there's been moments where I'm like, am I getting swept up and being a victim of buying in hysteria? I don't think I have been. I try to stay centered. I don't allow this to be a fear thing. Although there's been some anxiety and stress in dealing with work and family and everything. But I look at Italy, for instance, and what is going on over there is absolutely tragic. And potentially, they're a few weeks out ahead of us in the timeline. I mean, Tim, they had 2 days this week where they had 300-plus deaths 2 days in a row. So 300-plus people died within 1 day, 2 days in a row. And this is a modernized healthcare system with single payer. I mean, this is a developed modern country in Europe, and it's scary what's going on over there.
Well, what do you think about this? Because I'm starting to hear today, actually, like ways to deal with it, ways that, you know, the CDC and other, you know, high level, disease professionals are saying. There's a couple different models, and I think the Washington Post, if you go on their website, they have like 6 or 7 models of potentially how to deal with it. What one is interesting, I want to get your take on it, Mike, is I think UK was going to do this, but maybe I think they backed out, but Denmark is doing it. So it's what they're going to do is they're going to quarantine all the high risk people and the immune compromised, so elderly people, sick people, 2 months mandatory quarantine, no contact with the outside world whatsoever. But the rest of the population just go out and you know, function as normal. And people are going to go out and they're going to get sick, but, you know, they're going to develop herd immunity because, you know, they're going to feel lousy for 4 days. You know, they're going to have the symptoms, but then everyone will develop immunity to it and it'll run its course. But the other models where what the U.S. is doing is kind of like this social distancing model, is, you know, it's going to slow down people contracting it. And this is where you hear the term flatten the curve. So the concern is, right, everyone gets it all at once, right? The exponential, you know, everyone goes in a crowd and it blows up exponentially in a matter of days and the hospitals are overrun. And there's not enough resources and healthcare professionals to deal with this. So that they're trying to mitigate that. But the problem with like these quarantine models and the social distancing, you're going to get it eventually, you know, you're going to get it eventually, right? I mean, it's just going to slow down. So, you know, do you get it like Denmark? Do you just get it out of the way so you can get your economy back up and running in a couple weeks or months? Or do you draw it out to, you know, totally destroy your economy and means of production throughout the country in the meantime, and everyone's going to get it eventually, it just in a slower rate. So it's that philosophical thing that I find fascinating.
Well, I think there's a piece in there, though, Tim, that's critical to those two models, and it's a healthcare system piece where the United States approach with trying to flatten the curve and slow things down is because if you jump up to a certain point, you are going to overwhelm the healthcare system and they're not going to be able to handle it. And that is what the major concern and consideration is right now, taxing the healthcare system where people are not going to be able to get cared for. So by the social distancing piece, even though we're growing and spreading in cases, it's hopefully to be at a rate where some people are getting sick, getting healthcare that needed, while others are getting it delayed later. It's just you're not taxing the healthcare system. But I mean, the other concern with the first model you talked about, where the people that are quote unquote a healthier, less risk averse or less risk prone group, that they should just go out and get along with the world. Michael Osterholm, Joe's guest, was talking about how there's 40-year-olds that are on ventilators with this strain of virus. It's not predominant, and it's not a significant amount, but it's more than you're seeing with the general flu. So, and Joe even asked him, like, where did we get this sort of in our heads that this is an old person's epidemic? And they're clearly the more at-risk group, but it's not exclusive to them. So I think there's some concern about that Denmark model where you're putting people out in the world that maybe because of just the severe nature of this particular virus, that might be dicey, you know?
Right. And I think what everyone's saying, and Osterholm conceded this, is they just don't know. They don't have the data. And he said, you know, you have some people that contract the virus and don't show symptoms at all.
Yeah.
Just go through it. But the problem is you infect someone and it could devastate their system. And they've had those cases. So I think it's the unpredictability of, you know, what happens when you contract that's worrisome.
And what's really scary, I heard someone talking today about it, is there's data in China, and I don't think we have enough of a sample here as of yet. Healthcare workers in China were at a significantly higher rate of contracting this. And they don't know if it's because they have more exposure to like higher inoculation exposure or like what the necessarily the mechanism is for that. But healthcare workers had a higher rate of catching and being compromised. So it's just, you know, you worry about if those guys are not on the front lines. I mean, things can just unravel quickly. So it's crazy, man. It really is. It's crazy times right now. But I thought, Joe, it was prescient getting this guy on. I don't know if he had. I wonder if he like had him planned for a while in the timing of this, or if Joe, I didn't hear that, or if he pulled a favor and got this guy in quickly. Was that addressed at all, like the timing of how they got him in there?
So my understanding, Mike, is like they addressed it literally like in the opening remarks of the interview. Was like, wow, I can't believe like you reached out to me like last week, like before things started getting hectic. So like the time they found it coincidental about the timing of landing him. So it was I think he was just flat out lucky to get the guy when he did. And lucky for all of us, because I mean, the episode was, you know, super uber informative and timely.
Yeah. So Tim, let's put some parting shots together on this. So guys, again, this is the Joe Rogan Experience podcast, episode number 1439, guest Michael Osterholm. And Tim, it's already exceeded 11 million views in a week. So that is just unbelievable to wrap your head around the amount of views. I've seen people sharing it on Facebook who I wouldn't necessarily deem hardcore podcast or hardcore Rogan. I think this has kind of gotten out to the general mainstream because of the timing and the topic. So people are really paying attention to this episode, and it's a brilliant episode. And listen, I found it alarming. I hope people do tune into this and kind of have their paradigm shaken a little bit if they were sort of someone who's been dismissive or mocking of it. Some quick quotes. This is just the beginning. It's going to unfold for months to come. This is not the one to take lightly. And that, I think, in a nutshell, is what we in this country really need to heed the most. I think most really are getting that message and acting accordingly. So I thought it was an incredible episode. And again, a credit to the platform that Joe Rogan has built there to be able to attract these kind of guests, but have just a open-aired discussion, no pun intended, open air discussion about something that's as critical as what's going on in our world. So, dude, Mike, over to you for party shots on this episode.
So, Michael, I'd be remiss if I didn't bring this up. So, what's up with toilet paper, dude? Like, is that – I didn't – like, everyone's confounded about why toilet paper, and I don't have an answer. What are your thoughts, man?
Yeah, so the psychological thoughts, first off, of why people go out and scoop it all up, you mean?
Well, I understand that, you know, the hoarding, but yeah. Why in particular toilet paper?
Yeah, it's funny, man. I'll acknowledge something right now. I was sitting in my office, and this is probably a week before people really started looking to proactively gather stuff. And I heard a coworker just casually saying in the cubicle, like, yeah, you know, like the run on toilet paper is about that or something like that. And that day I went out and I didn't hoard, but I just bought like an extra like family stack of it and put it in my car. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Like if everyone just would behave normally with their buying patterns, there'd be no shortages. And I think everyone would be able to have as much stuff if they need. It's the panic induced overpurchase that clearly clears out the shop. But yeah, I don't know that one in particular. I guess people are fearful of just, having number twos and nothing to wipe with, that's our worst fear in this matter. I don't know, man.
So my father-in-law was at Walmart and picking up some supplies, and he had the chub pack of Charmin in his cart. And I think he like turned around to grab something else. And when he turned back around, someone swiped it from his cart, man.
Are you kidding me?
I swear, dude. Yep.
Oh, my gosh. What a world we live in. Now, I got to say, so I think it was last Thursday when really, I think that was the day you identified it, where it really started to turn and you could kind of feel it. And I went to Whole Foods on the way home, really having in my mind that I'm not going to be out and about that much, or definitely not going to work for the next 2 weeks. So I'm going to stop into Whole Foods and get some extra stuff. And everyone was being real polite. People were smiling at each other, orderly going through Whole Foods, but it was packed and everyone knew what everyone else was doing there. And Tim, you could feel sort of the humanity in the air, just the energy of it. There is something palpable when there, I don't want to call it an existential threat, even though maybe it is, but there's something, it's a very present focus feeling, and there's a higher energy emitting from everyone when you're in a moment like that and you're surrounded by community and everyone knows that there's something sort of dicey going on in the world. And I don't know, to everyone's credit, everyone was very orderly and respectful and kept it light, but you could just feel it in the air, man. Do you get where I'm going with that? Do you relate to that at all?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Saturday, we were with some people, and I know that was against probably better advice, but it was a small gathering of you know, people in the community, and you could feel like, you know, they would have your back, like in a crisis, if you needed a case of water or, you know, medicine or something, that you could count on community. And I think that's also a really cool lesson. I think, you know, not going down this road too much, but people look to high levels of government, you know, to maybe solve all their problems. And I think more realistically and more effectively, you know, it's your neighbor next door or, you know, the person across the street that's going to, you know, take care of you in a pinch more than someone in Washington, D.C. So I think that's the lesson, man.
Totally agree, dude. I have the ultimate faith in humanity, in neighborhoods, in neighbors, in community. I truly do. But I will give one quick prop as a left-leaning dude before we wrap up this segment. I saw Mitch McConnell today saying if any of this was on what they're dubbing like the COVID-2 package, the big package that's really going to be in relief directly to families and unemployment compensation, everything. He said, if any of my fellow Republicans have issues with this Democrat-led House bill that we are to vote on tomorrow, they need to just gag and vote for it. And I said, heck yeah, Mitch. Like, that's the right message. Like, listen, everyone rally around. People are struggling. This is not the time for silliness. And I appreciated that. Out of a dude I don't really appreciate much out of, I appreciated that. So maybe it's just, you know, I don't know. Maybe everyone's going to kind of just do their thing for the moment to help everyone get through this. Any commentary in return on that before we wrap?
No, I like it, man. I think we need more of that. So I'm on board, bro.
Awesome, man. So, dude, let's hit pause, and then we'll come back, and we'll each talk about something in the world of podcasts that has our attention, man.
It's going to be a hard one to follow, man.
Right on.
This episode of A Dude and a Bro podcast is brought to you by the fine folks at Podcorn. As you guys know, we love listening to and talking about podcasts. As podcasters ourselves, we understand the time and energy that goes into getting the right equipment, finding the time to record, and just the daily grind of promoting the show. There are hard costs to building a show, and monetizing your work is a critical component of growth. Enter Podcorn, who is disrupting the traditional and frankly outdated path to sponsorships. Podcorn is a user-friendly marketplace connecting podcasters to amazing sponsorship opportunities such as host read ads, interview segments, topical discussions, and more. At podcorn.com, you can get started with a user-friendly interface where you can easily browse potential sponsors. Podcorn gives you the flexibility to collaborate with these sponsors and choose the right opportunity that fits the size and scope of your show, and you never give up any rights to your podcast. Click on the link in our show notes to sign up to Podcorn and start browsing sponsorship opportunities right now. We want to give a big shout out to Podcorn. Thanks to Podcorn, A Dude and a Bro can continue to focus our energy and efforts on creating content for you and talking about the podcasts we love. Go to www.podcorn.com today to get started. That's www.podcorn.com. Later.
We are A Dude and a Bro podcast show. We are entrenched in podcasts. We want to do for the world of podcasting what Siskel and Ebert did for movies back in the day. So we love doing reviews of our favorite podcasts. We love suggesting new shows to all the fine folks out there in the world. And then Tim and I love debating topics from the latest and greatest episodes of our favorite podcast shows. Hey guys, you would do us a huge favor if you could head over to podchaser.com. Podchaser is your one-stop shop for all things related to podcasts and your favorite podcast shows. Search A Dude and a Bro podcast show and then leave us a review. If you could take a moment to drop a few lines about what it is you enjoy about A Dude and a Bro podcast show over on the Podchaser site, we'd be eternally grateful for your support. Thanks so much, guys.